Hey there, come on in. It's time for Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is we don't talk about Right Club, but for you, we're breaking the rule.
Hello, I'm Steph. Welcome to Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, I'm joined by Nicola, Pat, Teresa, and Linda. Happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
It's sad, we've got an empty chair around the table still. Heather's still not with us. We hope you get well very soon, Heather. And we look forward to welcoming you back to Write Club, the podcast, as soon as you can join us. Well, this week on Write Club, we're going to start the year with a bang. Pat will be reading to us from the work in progress and inviting us to offer her some constructive criticism. We'll be making some New Year's resolutions. We're going to talk about writing competitions, and Teresa has a very special announcement to make.
Yes.
Linda and Teresa are going to talk about their bedside tables. But first, Nicola is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Right, well, the author of this novel is someone who wrote a lot of, in my humble opinion, very bad horror stories. But he also went on to write one of my most favourite ever science fiction series in the whole wide world. All right, it won the Nebula Award for Best Novel. It's the in 2003 it was cited as the world's best-selling science fiction novel ever. It's set in a distant future, and it's about a noble family who accept a stewardship of desert planet Arrakis, and this planet is the only source of the spice melange. And the melange is the thing that all of the navigators of the spaceships use, and they have to have, it's basically a drug that they have to have in order to go through the wormholes and take people from place to place in the Galactic Federation. No, you're none the wiser. It was made into a 1984 film, which was directed by David Lynch, who also did David Lynch, come on.
American Beauty.
Blue Velvet.
Blue Velvet, yeah, most famous for Blue Velvet, yeah. It featured a grossly and immensely fat Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, who possessed a basso voice, and he required anti-gravity devices known as suspensors to support his weight. And in the film version, he was truly repulsive. Since 2009, the name of planets from this novel has been adopted for the real-life nomenclature. Well, okay, so they're using names from the novel to name features on Saturn's moon Titan.
Do you know?
No, I lost my glimmer there on the second clue.
Well, I had a glimmer, and I thought, is it Dune? Then I lost it.
It is indeed
June. Oh, really?
Well done.
I thought maybe it was a film I haven't actually read.
I'm being a bit mean because I know that none of you have read any science fiction, but this
is... I've read
Isaac Asimov.
Oh, okay.
And I recently read Planetfall. I must look up the author, but that's a good one.
The thing I found most... I mean, absolutely, I've read these books... all of them now, three times through. And they are so rich in detail and characterization and drawing from different cultures and things in the world. But I just found his horror really badly written.
Who's the author?
Frank Herbert. He wrote The Fog and various other awful things like that. Really badly written, I thought.
James Herbert.
Oh, dear.
The Fog.
I've been labouring under the illusion that this was the same person all these years.
Well, maybe it is.
No, I don't know.
It shifts his name.
I think you've just showed me up live on air there, Pat. Anyway,
I love them.
No, I don't think so. Anyway, I love them and highly recommend them.
Not very erudite.
Good. Well, we can put links to those books.
Yes. I think books that you go back to and read again and again are always
good books. Yeah.
I never read books again. The other thing I loved about it particularly is that they had a sisterhood of witches called the Bene Gesserit, and
that's what we should have called ourselves.
Yeah, the Bene Gesserit. But they talk about, there's a beautiful poem about fear, and it talks the Bene Gesserit teach themselves, because they're witch harlots basically. They go and live with kings, and they influence politics and things, and they're very very well educated and powerful women, which I think, you know, growing up as a teenager, I was drawn to those people. But this the Litany Against Fear, it's called, and I still have it on my desktop sometimes when I'm doing something I find particularly scary, because it talks about letting fear flow through you until there is nothing left. It's very beautiful. I'll read it for you another time.
Okay, thanks, Nicola. It's time now to hear from Pat and her work in progress. What can you tell us about it, Pat?
Well, I spoke a couple of weeks ago about my sort of writer's mind and the fact that even though I haven't been writing, I used to file away little snippets of conversations, situations, odds and ends that just sparked in me the idea that, you know, there was a story there waiting to be told. And this is one of those. When I was teaching, the deputy head came into the staff room one morning, and he'd had a letter from somebody requesting a reference about the pupil that was supposed to have attended the school some years before. And there were a number of staff still there who were around at that time. But nobody remembered this child. Nobody knew the name, and the head had looked through the files and the records and could find no trace. And the letter was very oddly worded, which left you... It really was a little puzzle. And I thought, that's interesting, intriguing. Mm. So I filed it away for future reference, and this is the beginning of the story that I've developed.
Fabulous.
Grew out of that. That's as much as I can say, really.
Good.
Okay. Peter had told her so many times about wearing those silly shoes, and now the accident he was always predicting had happened. She was almost more upset about having to admit he was right than about the fall. Luckily, she'd managed to break her fall by grabbing onto the low wall that ran along the front of next door's garden. She was shaken up and had grazed her hand on the privet hedge as she reached for the wall, but it was her pride that had suffered most. She didn't want to admit that at 77 she should give up wearing the high-heeled court shoes she'd worn all her life, like some dowdy old woman, she thought. Mariana was far from dowdy. Tall, elegant, smartly dressed, she wore carefully applied makeup and visited a hairdresser regularly. Her once naturally blonde hair needed a little assistance these days. Mark had seen the woman trip as she crossed the road ahead of him, but hadn't planned to get involved. Nothing to do with him, was it? But when he got closer, she was still leaning against the wall. Looked a bit ropey. He realised she was much older than he'd thought. You all right? She looked up at the young man, aware of him for the first time. He stood some distance away from her, his hands in his pockets. I'm fine, thank you. Just a little shaken. She stood, but as she put her weight onto her right foot, she buckled, the pain that shot through her ankle making her gasp. Mark put out his hand to steady her. Whoa, careful. My ankle. I think it's sprained, maybe. You sure it's not broken? Oh, I don't think so. She tried again to put some weight on it. No, I think it's okay. I only have a few yards to go. I live just here. She indicated the next house in the row. He glanced at the house. Nice place. One of them big white semis with red bricks round the door and windows. There were a lot of them round here. Solid looking. He couldn't just abandon her, could he? Lean on me, then. I'll give you an hand. She hesitated. Peter was always telling her to be careful, that she was too trusting. But I am an excellent judge of character, she always said. If you're suspicious of everyone, my darling, you will never have good things happen to you. She smiled at the young man and put her hand on his arm. Thank you. You are very kind, such a gentleman. It's a long time since I had such a handsome young escort. He flushed. The old dear's flirting with me. Mind you, I bet she was a looker when she was young. Bet you say that to all the boys. He started to relax, enjoying the unaccustomed banter. As they made their way slowly, she tried hard to disguise the pain she was feeling. I feel so foolish, she said, and my husband will tell me, I told you so. He thinks I should wear sensible shoes. Sensible shoes are for women with old lady duck feet, I tell him. Mark laughed. Well, I don't think you tick any of them boxes. You don't have duck feet and you ain't old. Exactly what I tell Peter. They turned into the drive of the house she'd indicated. Will your husband be in? Mark asked. He will be in the garden at the back, I think. Peter? Peter? A tall man, white-haired, appeared round the side of the house. When he saw Marianne limping and accompanied by a stranger, he hurried forward, concern evident in his features. What's happened? Don't fuss, Peter. I just tripped over a loose pavement. I'm fine. This lovely young man was kind enough to escort me home. Those silly shoes! How many times? See? Didn't I tell you he would say that? She looked triumphantly at Mark. I think she might have sprained her ankle. I don't know. You should probably strap it up or something, said Mark, suddenly awkward again. Yes, of course. Let's get you inside. Are you sure it's not broken? Maybe we should go to the hospital. It is not broken. I will be fine. Just let me sit down and rest. As Peter started to lead Marianna into the house, Mark stepped back, glad to be relieved of responsibility. Right, I'll leave you to it. Marianna reached out for his hand. Oh no, please, you mustn't go. You must come inside. Have a drink, perhaps. Or let me give you some money. No, no, you're all right. A part of him wanted to just go, get out of this situation, not be involved. Part of him wanted to respond to this old woman who thought he was a lovely young man. What harm could it do? All right, then. But I don't want no money. A drink, at least, she said, squeezing his hand.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
I'm loving the different voices and the characterisation. And, you know...
You read it very well as well.
Yeah, oh, thank you. Very nice.
You do your own audio books.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I'm wondering now... what's going to happen, and is he the right sort to invite into your house, and is there going to be trouble? Well, I presume yeah. there's going to be some sort of trouble ahead. And who is this delightful Marianne, you know, with her
the silly shoes,
slight accent and yeah and glamour, yeah. Yeah, so there's something a little bit exotic about her, I think.
Yeah, I like the foreshadowing you've done too with Mark, because there are little hints along the way that he may not be altogether on his straight. He seems a little, you know, because first of all, he didn't want to get involved. Yeah. And then he's looking at the house like, oh, it's a big, solid house. And also it's his not wanting to go in, but part of him wanted to go in, which made me think, well, there's something in him that wants to respond to her kindness, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I'm thinking, well, is he a robber? Was he going to, what was yeah. he doing in the
yeah,
neighborhood?
It does, yeah, you did say he started to relax, enjoying the unaccustomed, and I noticed you hesitated. Yeah. not sure if
I'm not happy with that word. I'm still like searching for the word.
It's a word that he would use, but she would not.
Bantery.
Yeah, I was going to.
But it wasn't really bantery. It is about warmth.
Attention.
Yeah. Attention. Yeah.
But what you're saying about the house, Linda, I was thinking, they're a bit respectable for him. He's not used to that environment. It's a, I have that feeling.
Right.
Which does lead to the question, what was he doing in that street in the first place?
Yeah. Passing through or not casing things? Who knows?
I thought, by and large, you handled the omniscient point of view very well. So we moved from, we started off in Mariana's world, and then Mark had seen the woman trip. So we're very clearly moving to Mark. Mm-hmm. Then she looks up at the young man and we're back in her head. The only place I thought that probably needed a little bit more attention to the detail is the where it says he flushed the old deer's flirting with me and he starts to relax. And then you said, as they made their way slowly, she tried hard to disguise the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And then we move, so we kind of duck between the two of them quite quickly. So if you could show him her trying hard to disguise the pain, that you could stay with him and not flick back to one and then back to the other. But apart from that, I thought you handled...
I noticed that as well. I thought that when you're doing Mark's point of view, sort of Marianne keeps... You slip into Marianne a couple of times.
But on the whole, I think the omniscient moves are easy to follow. It's just that particular area then. There. And I think you're right. The word attention, the unaccustomed attention and the unaccustomed... affection or whatever it is, kindness, that would add to it.
It's a great sort of juxtaposition here with Mark. Obviously, we have a feeling that he's not quite respectable, perhaps, but she is so elegant and from such another world. Yeah. It's a really good...
And she's an open person and she likes to trust people, and that's very endearing.
And wear silly shoes.
She wants to see the best in people.
And I love the idea of a 77-year-old woman wearing high-heeled shoes.
Because
I'm significantly younger than that. No, I don't wear high-heeled shoes and haven't done for very many years.
I had a friend of my godmother, and she worked in... I'm not sure that she was actually 77, but she worked in... She actually worked in the garment district in Manchester for many years as a sales person. And she was tall and slim and she lived on down a hill, actually called Factory Brew, because that's what a brew was. And she used to walk up and down that hill every day to get the bus to work.
In her heels?
In...
Wow.
Yeah. 3-4 inch stilettos.
Oh my word. Yeah.
And well into her 60s. I'm sure even into her early 70s, she was still wearing
bonnet shoes. It's very hard to change if your self perception is that you're always glamorous, always tidy, well dressed.
Thank God I don't suffer from that affliction.
I did have that self perception, and I did on my first child get up and shower, blow dry my hair, and put makeup on. But at some point
after your first child,
I remember with Phoebe, I used to get up and do all that for about I must have lasted at least 6 months. I know, because that was my perception of myself always wore makeup and always blow dried my hair.
It's like one sees women who continue to wear sexy clothes and things that other people might deem inappropriate for their age.
So good luck to them.
What makes you feel right, yourself.
But I think we've all known someone like Marianne because we're all relating to her, aren't we? It's not that she's inappropriate. She seems very elegant. It comes across very strongly.
Say what's appropriate.
Yeah,
quite right.
Yeah. So this is being developed from that letter that came into the school?
Yeah.
The whole I can't wait to hear more.
Well, because looking at the letter, you start thinking, well, why? And why is there no record of him? And the idea that you picked upon Mariana's accent, and yes, in fact, and the name, and yes, she's not of English origin. And it was the language of the letter that was written. The English was slightly odd.
Oh,
yeah. So that's what triggered me, the idea that they're foreigners, the people writing or the person writing is a foreigner. And how does somebody, how do you lose track of somebody in that way? Because, there were staff
It's very there, sad that would actually, have somebody known. Had their school whole school career and nobody remembered them.
Yes.
I think there's a few people out there that still remember me, maybe not for the right reasons.
Had he never been to that school and the application for a reference was just a punt in the dark?
Yeah. So that could have been
all those questions, and it's that what if factor, isn't it?
Yeah, it's done. And I bet you have the answer to them.
Well, I can't wait to find out what it is. So is this going to be a novel or a short story or a novella?
I think it's a long short story.
Hedge your bets, love.
Which perhaps will lead us on at some point to discuss what is a short story?
Yeah, right.
What is a novella?
Good point.
Never very sure.
Yeah. It could be a serial in Women's Weekly.
For which you'll be paid you'll probably get the momentous sum of £30 for that.
Oh, wow.
Well,
there's nothing wrong with that. Teresa banks her £54 with great pride.
Three decent bottles of wine.
I've got the check
frame, haven't you? Yeah, that would put me, halfway there to beating Teresa.
And you'd be, wouldn't be able to enter competitions and things then, would you?
No. Okay, well, look, it's probably time we moved on. Now, as I said at the top of the show, certainly in the UK, I don't know how you do it in the States, Linda, but in the UK, at New Year, it's customary to make resolutions, declare things that you intend to do better or differently this year. Do you do that in the US?
Well, of course we do, Steph. I don't know where you guys think the South is, or if it's buried under some mudslide somewhere, but yes, we make New Year's.
Okay, I'm sorry. I wasn't sure if it was like Guy Fawkes, which was very much just all pantomimes, which is very much a British thing. Yeah. So I know you've been fascinated by pantomimes. But so tell us about your New Year's resolutions then.
Well, first I wanted to ask you whether or not you have the tradition of making black-eyed peas with hog jaw for New Year's.
Oh, yeah.
Because
we'll do that.
No.
For good luck. And
black-eyed peas with
hog jaw, the jowls of the hog, because
hog jowls, pig cheeks,
pig cheeks,
pork and black-eyed beans. It sounds fine. Actually, sounds really delicious.
It is. And we eat it on New Year's Day.
I don't do pulses.
And
you
because
do pig
it will
jowls,
bring
though.
Good luck.
I do that.
And if it doesn't bring good luck, never mind, because it's very tasty anyway.
Good.
My resolutions. Well, it's probably very predictable. First, I want to finish the first draft of my work in progress about Mary Magdalene's journey. And secondly, I want to write on a more regular schedule. And I think I'm going to adopt Heather's method and do one full day a week because I find I really resent having to try to sit down every day and work out a time, and I'm not one of those who can say, all right, I'm going to do the same time every day. I don't know how people do that. I mean, you have lives to live, too. Mm-hmm. So Heather has it, right? She sits all day Tuesday on the couch, writes like crazy, doesn't stop all day. Her husband brings her food and drink. I just think it's a wonderful thing, and she's very productive.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to try that this year.
Okay.
What about you, Teresa? What's your New Year's resolution?
Well, as you guys know, I've got a play that I've started, and I've set it aside for a couple of months because, I just felt it needed a bit more thinking about before pushing on. So I don't know if I dare say this out loud, but what I'd like to do in January is try and maybe get to the end of the first draft of that.
Oh, good.
Yeah, because I feel of the other things I'm in the middle of, that's the most achievable. Because obviously a novel is a massive undertaking. Mm. So that's the first resolution. Yeah, write more, be more disciplined, be more organised. I've been saying this for my whole life.
You don't sound very convinced.
I'm not convincing myself, but, hey, let's give it a try.
You know what they say about the road to hell? What about you, Pat?
Well, very similar to Linda, really, and Teresa. First one, to finish the things I've started. I've got two short stories on the go, neither of which is yet finished. So
That's a definite. And then the other one is to be more disciplined. I don't think the day will work for me, but I was thinking a sort of maybe a weekly target. Whether that's going to be sort of daily. And again, I don't think a particular time mm-hmm. would work for me, but whether I think, you know, an hour a day or 2 hours a day, or whether I just do a sort of target for the week.
Or a number of words. That makes sense.
Yeah.
How about you, Nicola?
Well, I'd like to share some tips, really, because I'm neck deep in the personal development world, as you know, from my, quote, day job, unquote. It's hardly a whole day. But the thing is about New Year's resolutions is you shouldn't just make New Year's resolutions about the same things if you haven't done them previously. You need to change something in your environment to create a more conducive environment to make the changes you want to make. So, for example, you're going to change from just trying to write and always feeling like you should be writing and not doing it mm-hmm. to dedicating a day. And that's quite a good practical way of right. changing your environment and seeing if that helps you more.
So that's why Linda sounds more convincing than Teresa.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Because Teresa didn't say then what she was going to do to make it easier. Yeah. And I'm a great believer in making things easier. You know, I don't want to ever make things harder for people, because what's the point in that? We're you know, writing is supposed to be fun, isn't it, and enjoyable enriching and rewarding and all those things, and you can't do it if you feel bad about it. But so for myself, I'm very deadline driven, as I've mentioned before, so I'm going to make a list of all the competitions I could enter this year mm-hmm. and start submitting bits of the book that I'm writing. I've only written 2 chapters so far, and they're very short chapters. So I'm going to try and write bits and submit them to competitions, because I think that will really help me with the deadline thing. And I also want to make, you know, space. I definitely want to carve out a whole day, if not a day and a half, to where I don't take any appointments for work, because I'm freelance. I work for myself and I have my own business. So I let people impinge on my time, because their agendas always feel more urgent than my own. Yeah. And because it's
so blank the days out first, make those a priority. I've found that if you really do want to, write, you have to stop treating it as a hobby and start treating it as a job, taking yourself more seriously.
That goes to what I was saying a few weeks ago when I was telling you about the book, The War of Art, and he's saying, you know, you have to, resistance is like a telemarketer. If you answer the phone and say hello, it's too bad that a pro doesn't even pick up the phone. Mm. And I think that's really important. Mm.
There's another great book by, in a similar vein, which is talked about in the same breath, really, as The War of Art, which is Simon Sinek's, Your Reason Why. It's just called, and I think we've all got to connect with our reason why. You know, why do we want to do this? Otherwise, we're just giving ourselves another stick to beat ourselves with, and something else we feel we're not doing or achieving.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And so if you could just think about why you want to do this, and then think, you know, what do I need to put in place so that I've got a supportive environment to support me in that why?
That's great advice.
In the summer, I put myself in a place where I would get all my work done in the morning so I could go off and have a nice time in the afternoon. And I think that's now winter's come. I've got to find a way to do that so I can get anything I need to do and look forward to writing like I looked forward to going out and having a lovely time in the summer.
Mm. I call that procrastination. That tends to be what I do, but there you go. It's interesting, though, that you say that you're thinking of entering a few writing competitions, because it occurred to me that that might be a way to get my juices flowing. And, you know, I'm on my editing of the first draft of my novel, so I need to find another project. And that might help with something. Teresa, you've actually not only entered competitions in the past, but you've actually won them.
I've won a couple of small things, yes.
Well, don't be modest. It's a few small things more than I've won.
And it does. It gives you a massive boost. It's the most exciting, wonderful thing when you get an email saying you've won something. It's like, woo! Share champagne with me today. Well, that's, you know. But and picking up on what Nicola was saying about deadlines, I think that's that's something that many others, writers, have a problem with, because nobody is setting you a deadline saying you've got to have 10,000 words by Wednesday or whatever. So the first competition, maybe not the first one I entered, but I'd written one act of a short comedy, and I saw this competition probably on Facebook, somebody had shared it, and it was asking for a short comedy of no more than 50 minutes duration, no more than four actors and simple staging. And the work that I'd already started fitted the brief perfectly. But the dead date for that competition then gave me the impetus to finish it. So it does. That's one aspect of it.
And did you win the competition?
That one I did win. That was the Grand Words competition from Blackpool.
Did you win money?
Yeah.
There was £100.
Oh, more than 50%.
Yeah, that's prize money. That's not earnings. Just in case the tax man's listening, that's prize money.
Right. And that's not taxable in the UK.
I believe not.
Okay.
Help, I'm in trouble if I've got it wrong. And other competitions, short story competitions I've entered, it's just been at the time I thought, oh, I could have a go at that. So I haven't necessarily had something ready or started. So the RAC one, the brief was a 1,000-word short story on the theme writing in Europe, and I thought, oh, I'll come up with something for that. And I've entered various things. There was one, most of which I've got absolutely nowhere with. I've entered the Dragonfly Tea competition a couple of times. The National Motor Museum at Bewley had one for a 300-word story or poem, which I didn't get anywhere with, but a friend of mine was a runner-up. But the other thing is, it does give you an enormous boost. And one thing I didn't realise, that many of these smaller competitions, they're getting less than 100 entries, whereas the Dragonfly Tea, for example, is very well known, and they get thousands of entries now. So, you know, you're increasing your chances if it happens that the competition isn't very very wide. I think the Bewley one, I'm sure they said when they announced the winner that they'd had over 70 entries.
Oh, really?
Which is not many.
No, it isn't.
And yet, I would say the top three were of a high standard. They were very good.
Mm.
I entered the Dragonfly Tea one about the journey, and now I've installed Grammarly. I can see why I didn't get anywhere.
Well, I actually spotted something the other day which I thought anybody can enter, and you don't even really need to be doing anything special, because it's the Telegraph Just Back Travel Writing Competition. And basically, it's a monthly competition. There's £200 prize in your choice of currency, and it's free to enter. And all you have to do is produce 500 words of gripping detail about somewhere that you've just come back from. So when you go on your holidays and you've got all that time to rest and relax, take a notebook with you, write your 500 words about the place that you're traveling, and enter the Telegraph competition. You know, you could do 12 a year if you travel on business. You can do 12 a year.
Yeah.
What they say is they want something a shade more interesting than the local park. But you can read the previous winners on their website. One of them was a voyage across the Mersey. So it doesn't mean you don't have to be travelling anywhere exotic, but it's all about travel.
I've just been on a ferry across the Tagus a couple of weeks ago. Well, I could do that.
There you go. So that's the Telegraph Just Back Travel Writing Competition, which, as I say, is monthly, 500 words a month. So I might give that one a go the next time I do travelling. Every month.
What is the deadline then for each month?
You'll have to go through on the competition page, but I'll get the link put up on our Facebook group.
Well, this one caught my eye, as we're all talking about competitions. Tell a Tale Gothic Fiction. And this is a flash fiction competition, which means a very short story. And in this case, the word limit is 500 words. And normally, that doesn't include the title. So you don't count it in your word count. So they're asking for a 500-word tale of terror using the following quotation from The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It might be possible, of course, that far from being one, we may possess two selves. So that's the prompt for the competition. And the closing date for that, and again, the details will be on our Facebook group, so don't worry. The deadline is Saturday, the 21st of April, 2018. And it's free and open to persons of all ages who reside in the UK. So
So you can't... Are you resident in the UK, Linda, or are you just a visitor by... Well, let's not answer that in case the wrong people are listening.
I'm an American citizen.
And she's proud of it.
No, I'm not. So I live in both worlds, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoy the time in both. I wanted to say something about the competition you just mentioned. 500 words, gripping words, about a place you've just been. And I thought of the opening line of a book you read recently on your name, the novel somewhere. I'm in a coma. I was in a coma.
Yeah, yeah.
I was in a funk. Might be fun. Well, I have one here that's for, it's the competition for the Bath, it's the Bath Children's Novel Award. So, and they're looking for the best unsigned novelist across the globe. And this one is worth, if you can dash off a children's novel right away, £2,000 prize.
Wow.
How much is that in dollars, £2,000?
It's about $2,500,
$600.
That's all?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought we had...
We're almost level now.
Oh. That's right. The UK is... founded.
Move on.
And also, in addition to the £2,000, you get a literary agent introduction. So
that's really worthwhile. Yeah. Yeah, they've couched that very well, haven't they? Because they've said a literary agent introduction. They're not guaranteeing they'll take you on.
No, of course not.
No, but...
But I know very often with these big, certainly these big competitions, literary agents are the judges.
They do keep
and
an
certainly,
eye.
And certainly, if you look at... For example, can't think of one off the top of my head. I believe Gail Honeyman, who wrote Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine, I believe that she was picked up through entry into a competition. And I know Aisha Mackay, who will be publishing the first of two books next June, we'll be welcoming her to the podcast later in this year. I know that she entered the Richard and Judy Find a Bestseller competition or Search for a Bestseller competition and was shortlisted, and that's how she got her deal. So they're certainly worth entering. It's not all about winning. It's about raising your profile.
Right.
Or even indeed the prize money.
Yeah.
Well, the prize money would always help, wouldn't it? These impoverished writers.
Is it non-taxable?
Prizes
are winnings.
Okay. I think
tax expert, please don't take advice from me. Check with somebody else.
Check with your accountant.
Yes, it's true. As someone who's won several poker tournaments,
this one was established in 2013, and its purpose was to support and spotlight unsigned novelists around the world. It's around the world, people. We can all enter. And they say here, they've written, we are known for our track record in helping writers find literary agent representation. All our 2016 shortlistees were snapped up by literary agents.
Ooh, wow.
And so far, too, have signed publishing deals, including a six-figure contract.
Oh, wow. Those magic words.
Wow. Yeah. Well, okay. Pat, how about you? Are you going to be doing any competitions, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm not sure about this one, though the length of the submissions is possibly quite attractive. This is the Bristol Short Story Prize, and the closing date for this one is May the 1st of this year, 2018, and the maximum length of submissions for this is 4,000 words. Again, not including the title. There's no minimum length. Stories can be on any theme or subject and are welcome in any style, including graphic, verse or genre-based.
Wow.
Interesting. It's open to all published and unpublished writers.
Ah.
And it's open to... There's no geographical restriction on entry.
Mm-hmm. Okay, friend of mine who's actually from Switzerland, she's Swiss origin, she was shortlisted last year, which I was stunned by because it's not even her first language, English. It was written in English. I think the entries have to be written in English, don't they?
Yes.
But you can be
What constitutes a published author? For example, if you published a story on your own blog,
Well,
they talk about self-published and published, but it's worth checking the competition rules thoroughly.
They vary, and they will vary. Specifically say if it's self-published, that's okay, we still consider
some others will say if it's already been put out there or submitted as an assignment on a course,
must never have been previously published in print or online, including self published ebook, magazines, journals, websites, blogs, social networks.
Oh, okay. So they're looking for really original stuff.
Or broadcast or won a prize in any other writing competition on or before October 13th, 2018.
So if we're reading our stuff out on this podcast, then are we negating ourselves from certain competitions?
Possibly. It's just worth checking the fine print on any competition that you're entering to make sure that you can meet the criteria, because they'll all be different.
Prizes for this one. Each of the shortlisted authors, I think they will shortlist about 21 stories, and each one will be included in the Bristol Short Story Prize anthology. And they're up to volume 11, so presumably this has been running for some time. And each of the shortlisted authors will receive 2 free copies of the paperback version. We'll be able to purchase further copies at a discount of 50%. The other prizes, first prize is £1,000, second prize £700, third prize £400, and each of the 17 remaining shortlisted writers will receive £100.
So you should be shortlisted. That's a big prize.
And
then
you're included in an anthology, and so
on. So that's worth it too.
So yeah, it's a nice one.
Good.
How about fee?
Yeah, sorry. Well remembered. £8.
Oh, I thought it's going to be £150.
No, it's quite expensive. £8 is quite expensive.
It's very well known, prestigious
company. It is.
Decent.
Nicola, how about you?
Well, I found 2 for you. I found the Roswell Award for Short Science Fiction by Adults 18+. Across the globe, it's an international competition. There's first, second and third prizes, certificates. You get a star of the science fiction genre scene reading out your submission if you win. The submissions are free. First prize, £500, second, £250, third, £100. And they've got the thing I liked particularly about this was they've got an aside prize, if you like, of Women Hold Up Half the Sky Award, which is a special award for the writing that they feel is best representing the science fiction feminist genre, which is a subgenre, and one I'm very keen on, having read a lot of Sherry Tepper, who writes in that genre. And the other thing is that
what's the closing date?
It's going at the moment, and the closing date is, 1 second, I can't find it now. Typical. January the 29th, 2018.
So we need to pull our fingers out if we want to enter that one.
But they're also doing one for the under 18s as well, and it can be a single writer or a team of writers, and they're doing a special side award again for an ecology based story, so you can enter the main competition, and if you've written one about the ecology or geography or culture or environmental concerns, in fact, then you can enter, you'll automatically be entered into the special. It's called the Green Feather Award.
Excellent. That's lovely. Well, thank you, everybody.
A question?
Yes.
I mean, I must admit, apart from odd magazines, things in newspapers, I don't think I was ever really aware of the number of competitions that there are. So where do you go to find out about them all?
The answer is there are loads and loads and loads of places you can go, but I haven't got them prepared, so Google. I couldn't tell you. Yeah. Now, I said at the beginning of the show that Teresa had a very special announcement to make.
Indeed.
So we are talking about competitions, Teresa, why don't you tell us what our very special announcement is?
I will. I'm delighted to announce that we're going to be holding our own flash fiction writing competition. The lucky winner will be invited to join us on the show. All you have to do is write a short story of up to 500 words, not including the title, on the subject of new beginnings. Email it to us at competition@writeclubthepodcast.com by midnight on January 31st, 2018. We're really, really lucky and excited that we got a celebrity judge. The author of historical fiction, Carol McGrath, will be judging the competition for us. It's free to enter, and you'll find details on our Facebook group. If you haven't already joined us, go onto Facebook and search for Write Club the Podcast.
Fabulous. Now, I'd just like to make it clear to all the ladies around the table here and to Heather at home, you are not eligible to enter our competition.
Not fair.
Because you're already on the show.
So. And am I assuming that's midnight UK time?
Midnight UK time on the 31st of January. That's the last minute between 11:59 PM.
For those procrastinators about.
That's pretty darn sure. We probably have some American listeners, and midnight's going to be different. I don't think they should be discriminated against.
Well, they can just look it up on the world time.
Maybe we will. Maybe we will make it clear on the Facebook group what time it is involved if you're living. Yes. The thing is, America's got several time zones, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Three.
Four.
Pacific's always four, is it?
Yeah.
Pacific, Central and Eastern. What else? What's the other one?
Mountain.
Oh, I thought Mountain was the same as Central.
No.
I don't think so. But then I was just remembering, I think the American time is before British.
Yeah. So don't leave it till late in the day.
Let's put it this way, Linda. You're always behind us.
Oh, dear. Oh, moving swiftly on. Okay, well, it's nearly time for us to go, I'm afraid. But before we do, we've just got time to ask Teresa and Linda to tell us what they're reading at the moment. Linda, what's on your bedside table?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I have a book by one of the best, in my opinion, one of the best short story writers of all time. And the copy I have here, those of you listen can't see, but here
it's
a bit flattered. That's an old book.
And I have to, I have already ordered another copy. And if you look through
the pages are all falling out.
But I've written on it, this one is a good example of present tense, first person. I go through his book and read and use it to learn from. Raymond Carver, unfortunately, he died young. Mm. He died in his 50s. But he was just, there's this school of fiction, I think it was started back in the 80s, and the term is dirty realism.
Mm.
And
I love Raymond Carver.
Yeah, oh, you do good. Mm. And it's about people who are kind of, dirty realism deals with people who are kind of on the edge, or people without resources, who are isolated perhaps, or desperate in whatever situation. And that doesn't mean just financially. I mean, it can be isolated and desolate, you know, because of your attitude or emotions or whatever. So, but the reason I really enjoy it, and it's also minimalist kind of fiction. Mm. No spare words. It's straightforward. Mm. It's honest, it's very compassionate, but it just strips everything to the bare bones. And the meaning is always conveyed through objects and context, no metaphors, no internal dialogues, anything like that. And I often go back to him just to remind me not to overdo, don't get flowery. and it makes me want to re-edit whatever I've done when I read him. He's really, it's wonderful. This book that I have that's falling apart is a collection of short stories called Cathedral. And the title story deals with a man who is kind of, you know, not very emotionally in touch with his wife or his self or his life. But he's not really aware of that. True circumstances, a blind man comes to visit. He and his wife, him and his wife, and they, at one point in the evening, after a few drinks and a joint or whatever, and they're listening to the television, and there's a thing on about cathedrals, and the character says, "Well, you've never seen a cathedral, have you?" to the blind man, and realizing that, and the blind man said, "No, but do me a favor," and he asked, "Get pencil and some heavy paper, and draw for me this cathedral." And And he thought, well, that's ridiculous. But when he sat down to do it, the blind man puts his hand on the hand of the man who's drawing and follows it along. Mm. He says first he just drew a box, you know, and then he put some windows. But then he got into it. And the man just following his hand. And it opened his eyes to so much more because it was an experience for him that it was an emotional experience seeing this man enjoy drawing his simple little cathedral. It's a wonderful story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I could listen to you forever, Linda.
Yeah. You weave a spell with your accent.
You certainly do.
What accent? You guys have an accent.
Well, Teresa, in your accent, would you like to tell us what's on your bedside table?
Yes, sorry, I was quite transfixed there. I forgot I had to do something. At the moment, I'm reading Thackeray's Barry Lyndon, mainly because I read that the eponymous hero was based on the real-life Andrew Robinson Stoney. If you remember, a couple of weeks ago, I was reading Wedlock. Well, Stoney was the real-life villain dubbed George and Britain's Worst Husband by Wendy Moore. So I was intrigued to see what Thackeray's contemporary take on him was, because obviously it was written around the same time that this scandal was occurring. Thackeray gives us a picaresque romp. So Lyndon travels from Ireland to continental Europe. Presumably he will be in England later, I haven't got that far, having various military and amorous adventures along the way. But the hero is far from the lovable rogue Ryan O'Neill portrays in Kubrick's 1975 film. Lyndon is a spoilt young man, brought up to believe that though poor, he is entitled to a life of wealth and status. He leaves Ireland believing he's killed a rival in a duel and becomes a soldier. Through trickery and deceit, he manages to escape one army, only to be kidnapped and forced to become a mercenary in the Prussian army. That's as far as I've got, but I'm enjoying it enormously. It's a book where the villain thinks he's a hero. Because it's told in the first person, Lyndon is self-condemned by his own utterances. So far, it's a road trip through Ireland and Europe during the Seven Years' War. And unlike some 19th century books, I'm finding it light and easy to read. Mm. And, of course, being out of copyright, it's free to download in digital form.
Ah, you can put the link to that one on the Facebook group. Thanks, Teresa. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time again. So that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. We do hope you've enjoyed the show. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a review. Remember to check the Facebook group for details of all the links and resources and for details of our competition. We wish you all a very productive new year. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye. Bye.